Well, you're joining us now as U.S. President Joe Biden gets set to deliver his second State of the Union address. All eyes are on Capitol Hill as Biden is expected to speak to a deeply divided Congress about economic uncertainty and policing reform. The war in Ukraine and tensions with China are also expected to be on the agenda. Biden goes into the speech with a flagging approval rating of 42%, one of the worst ever second-year approval ratings for a U.S. president. Let's now go live to our White House correspondent, Kimberly Halkett. She's there at Capitol Hill. So, Kimberly, we're expecting a speech with unavoidable international issues, but he's very much hoping to woo a domestic U.S. audience with the bulk of his address, isn't he?
Yeah, there's no question that this is a pivotal speech for Joe Biden. This is the president's second State of the Union address, but there's a key difference this time. And that key difference is that this time he speaks to a divided Congress. Previously, Joe Biden's Democrats controlled both the House of Representatives as well as the U.S. Senate. This time, that is not the case. The House of Representatives controlled by opposition Republicans. And so he has that backdrop. He also has the backdrop of poll numbers, which are among the lowest of his presidency. And so he makes a pitch to the American public for another term in office. In many cases, this is a de facto pitch, if you will, to the American public for another term in the White House. And so the U.S. president is not only going to be, throughout this speech, highlighting the successes that he sees of the past 2 years, but also making the case for another four. Now, as we watch these pictures, you've seen the members of the cabinet. They've been filing into the House of Representatives. Already, we've seen the members of the House of Representatives seated, as well as the members of Congress from the U.S. Senate seated. There's also, you'll see on the left of your screen there, the members of the judiciary. That's the members of the Supreme Court. What we're waiting for now is the Sergeant of Arms to bring in or announce the arrival of U.S. President Joe Biden. You can also see there the First Lady, Dr. Jill Biden, as well as Vice President Kamala Harris's husband, as well, the first gentleman as well. He is seated there. And also in the gallery, there are some very pivotal guests that often give us a bit of a roadmap to the president's priorities that he'll be laying out in the speech. We know, for example, that Tyre Nichols' parents, you'll remember that Tyre Nichols was the man that was killed in that very graphic video that came out of Memphis. He was the victim of police brutality, of those five Memphis police officers. Accompanying Dr. Jill Biden will be his stepfather as well as his mother as the president addresses police reform in his speech. We also know that accompanying the First Lady will be the Ukraine ambassador to the United States as the president once again underscores the importance of U.S. support for Ukraine. And we also know that there will be as well activism that will be addressed. And it looks like the president is about to come in. So let's listen as Joe Biden walks in and greets those that are gathered in the chamber.
Kimberly, as we see him coming in here, very much a pitch to a domestic audience, but as you say, he can't ignore the ongoing war in Ukraine and issues regarding China, can he?
No, and that's definitely something that he will have to address. And of course, he will also, we expect, address the earthquake that has just taken place and the thousands of lives that have been lost recently in Turkey and in Syria. We expect that he is also going to talk about just that tragedy and the U.S. commitment to rebuilding there. We expect that he will once again pledge for ongoing commitments for international support continuing in Ukraine and appeal to U.S. partners and allies. And as well, we expect that he will potentially given the incident of the Chinese spy balloon that has drifted over the United States in the last week. He may even have some harsh words for China. We know in previous year he only mentioned China about three times in his State of the Union speech, and many are watching to see if he will mention it more this time around. And we should also point out that the back at the of the chamber there, you see the vice president as well as the House Speaker. That's Vice President Kamala Harris as well as the House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Once the president gets to the podium, he will turn around and he will hand each of them a copy of his speech. You will remember, perhaps some of our viewers will remember in previous years when Donald Trump was president, that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi famously ripped up Donald Trump's speech. We don't expect that to be the case this time around, but we watch very carefully to see what kind of body language there will be as there is that interaction. You have to remember that Kevin McCarthy is a Republican. Joe Biden is a Democrat. And you have to also remember that Joe Biden was once a U.S. senator. So he is very comfortable on Capitol Hill. He has been in this chamber, in the audience, many, many times, watching the State of the Union address. Now, of course, he gives this address as a president. And we know the president will be speaking about a number of key issues. Not only will he be highlighting his successes, a couple of legislative agenda items that he believes are successful, for example, his infrastructure law, as well as combating inflation. He's going to talk about the very successful low unemployment numbers, some of the lowest in a half century. But we also know the president's going to talk to Congress about spending more money to help improve ordinary Americans' lives. He's going to call on Congress to spend more on cancer research and things like mental health and combating the opioid addiction in the United States, as well as combating the high suicide rate when it comes to veterans. So you can see there the president continuing to make his way through the crowd as he makes his way towards the podium. The president is going to talk a lot about the economy. Again, the president is still dealing with some very high inflation numbers, and this is kind of the crux of one of the president's problems when it comes to his low approval ratings, the fact that ordinary Americans are still struggling to pay some very high prices. So we watch very carefully to see what the president will say about that. He's approaching, he's shaking hands with the House Speaker and the Vice President. Soon he'll hand them a copy of the speech, and then he will, he's about to deliver it now. Let's take a listen.
Hello, hello, hello. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Members of Congress, I have the high privilege and the distinct honor to present to you the President of the United States.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. You can smile. It's okay. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you. Please.
Mr. Speaker, Madam Vice President, our First Lady and Second Gentleman, good to see you guys up there. Members of Congress. By the way, Chief Justice, I may need a court order. She gets to go to the game tomorrow, next week. I have to stay home. Got to work something out here. Members of the Cabinet, leaders of our military, Chief Justice, Associate Justice, and retired Justice of the Supreme Court, and to you, my fellow Americans. You know, I start tonight by congratulating the 118th Congress and the new Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy. Speaker, I don't want to ruin your reputation, but I look forward to working with you. And I want to congratulate the new leader of the House Democrats, the first African-American minority leader in history, Hakeem Jeffries. He won in spite of the fact I campaigned for him. Congratulations to the longest serving leader in the history of the United States Senate, Mitch McConnell. Where are you, Mitch? And congratulations to Chuck Schumer, another term as Senate Minority Leader. I think you... Only this time you have a slightly bigger majority, Mr. Leader. You're the majority leader. About that much bigger? Yeah. Well, I tell you what. I want to give special recognition to someone who I think is going to be considered the greatest speaker in the history of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi. The story of America is a story of progress and resilience, of always moving forward, of never, ever giving up. It's a story unique among all nations. We're the only country that has emerged from every crisis we've ever entered stronger than we got into it. Look, folks, that's what we're doing again. 2 years ago, the economy was reeling. I stand here tonight after we've created, with the help of many people in this room, 12 million new jobs, more jobs created in 2 years than any president's created in 4 years because of you all, because of the American people. 2 years ago, COVID had shut down, our businesses were closed, our schools were robbed of so much, and today, COVID no longer controls our lives. And 2 years ago, democracy faced its greatest threats in the Civil War. And today, though bruised, our democracy remains unbowed and unbroken. As we gather here tonight, we're writing the next chapter in the great American story, a story of progress and resilience. When world leaders ask me to define America, and they do, believe it or not, I say I can define it in one word, and I mean this, possibilities. We don't think anything is beyond our capacity. Everything is a possibility. You know, we're often told that Democrats and Republicans can't work together. But over the past 2 years, we've proved the cynics and naysayers wrong. Yes, we disagreed plenty. And yes, there were times when Democrats went alone. But time and again, Democrats and Republicans came together to defend a stronger and safer Europe. It came together to pass once in a generation infrastructure law, building bridges connecting our nation and our people. We came together to pass the most significant law ever, helping victims exposed to toxic burn pits. And in fact, it's important. And in fact, I signed over 300 bipartisan pieces of legislation since becoming president, from reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act, the Electoral Count Reform Act, the Respect for Marriage Act that protects the right to marry the person you love. And to my Republican friends, if we could work together the last Congress, there's no reason we can't work together and find consensus on important things in this Congress as well. Folks, you all are as formed as I am, but I think the people sent us a clear message. Fighting for the sake of fighting. Power for the sake of power, conflict for the sake of conflict gets us nowhere. That's always been my vision of our country, and I know it's many of yours, to restore the soul of this nation, to rebuild the backbone of America, America's middle class, and to unite the country. We've been sent here to finish the job, in my view. For decades, the middle class has been hollowed out in more than, and not no one administration, but for a long time. Too many good-paying manufacturing jobs move overseas. Factories closed down. Once thriving cities and towns that many of you represent became shadows of what they used to be. And along the way, something else we lost. Pride, our sense of self-worth. I ran for president to fundamentally change things, to make sure our economy works for everyone, so we can all feel that pride in what we do, to build an economy from the bottom up and the middle out, not from the top down. Because when the middle class does well, the poor have a ladder up, and the wealthy still do very well. We all do well. I know a lot of you always kid me for always quoting my dad, but my dad used to say, Joey, a job's about a lot more than a paycheck. He really would say this. It's about a lot more than a paycheck. It's about your dignity. It's about respect. It's about being able to look your kid in the eye and say, honey, it's going to be okay, and mean it. Well, folks, so let's look at the results. We're not finished yet by any stretch of the imagination, but unemployment rate is at 3.4%, a 50-year low. A near record unemployment. Near-record unemployment for Black and Hispanic workers. We've already created, your help, 800,000 good-paying manufacturing jobs, the fastest growth in 40 years. And where is it written? Where is it written that America can't lead the world in manufacturing? And I don't know where that's written. For too many decades, we imported projects and exported jobs. Now, thanks to what you've all done, we're exporting American products and creating American jobs. Folks, inflation has been a global problem because the pandemic disrupted our supply chains, and Putin's unfair and brutal war in Ukraine disrupted energy supplies as well as food supplies, blocking all that grain in Ukraine. But we're better positioned than any country on earth right now. But we have more to do. But here at home, inflation is coming down. Here at home, gas prices are down $1.50 from their peak. Food inflation is coming down, not fast enough, but coming down. Inflation has fallen every month for the last 6 months, while take-home pay has gone up. Additionally, over the last 2 years, a record 10 million Americans applied to start new businesses. 10 million. And by the way, every time someone starts a small business is an act of hope. And Madam Vice President, I want to thank you for leading that effort to ensure that small businesses have access to capital and the historic laws we enacted that are going to just come into being. Standing here last year, I shared with you a story of American genius and possibilities. Semiconductors, small computer chips the size of a fingerprint that power everything, from cell phones to automobiles and so much more. These chips were invented in America. Let's get that straight. They were invented in America. We used to make 40% of the world's chips. In the last several decades, we lost our edge. We're down to only producing 10%. We all saw what happened during the pandemic when chip factories shut down overseas. Today's automobiles need 3,000 chips, each of those automobiles. But American automobiles couldn't make enough cars because there weren't enough chips. Car prices went up. People got laid off. So did everything from refrigerators to cell phones. We can never let that happen again. That's why we came together to pass the Bipartisan Chips and Science Act. Folks, I know I've been criticized for saying this, but I'm not changing my view. We're going to make sure the supply chain for America begins in America. The supply chain begins in America. We've already created. We've already created 800,000 new manufacturing jobs without this law, before the law kicks in. With this new law, we're going to create hundreds of thousands of new jobs across the country. And I mean all across the country, throughout not just the coast, but through the middle of the country as well. That's going to come from companies that have announced more than $300 billion in investment in American manufacturing over the next few years. Outside of Columbus, Ohio, Intel is building semiconductor factories on 1,000 acres, literally a field of dreams. It's going to create 10,000 jobs, that one investment, 7,000 construction jobs, 3,000 jobs in those factories once they're finished. They call them factories. Jobs paying an average of $130,000 a year, and many do not require a college degree. Jobs. Because we work together, these jobs are people don't have to leave home to search for opportunity. It's just getting started. Think about the new homes, the small businesses, the medium-sized businesses. So much more that's going to be needed to support those 3,000 permanent jobs and the factories that are going to be built. Talk to mayors and governors, Democrats and Republicans, and they'll tell you what this means for their communities. We're seeing these field of dreams transform to the heartland. But to maintain the strongest economy in the world, we need the best infrastructure in the world. And folks, as you all know, we used to be number one in the world in infrastructure. We've sunk to 13th in the world. The United States of America, 13th in the world in infrastructure, modern infrastructure. But now we're coming back because we came together and passed the bipartisan infrastructure law, the largest investment in infrastructure since President Eisenhower's interstate highway system. And folks, already we've funded over 20,000 projects, including major airports from Boston to Atlanta to Portland. Projects that are going to put thousands of people to work, rebuilding our highways, our bridges, our railroads, our tunnels, ports, airports, clean water, high-speed internet, all across America, urban, rural, tribal. And folks, we're just getting started. We're just getting started. And I mean it sincerely. I want to thank my Republican friends who voted for the law and my Republican friends who voted against it as well. But I still get asked to fund the projects in those districts as well. But don't worry. I promised I'd be a president for all Americans. We'll fund these projects. And I'll see you at the groundbreaking. Look. This law will further unite all of America. Projects like Brent Spence Bridge in Kentucky over the Ohio River, built 60 years ago, badly needed repairs, one of the nation's most congested freight routes, carrying $2 billion worth of freight every single day across the Ohio River. And folks, I've been talking about fixing it for decades, but we're really finally going to get it done. Yes. I went there last month with Democrats and Republicans and from both states to deliver a commitment of $1.6 billion for this project. And while I was there, I met a young woman named Sarah, who's here tonight. I don't know where Sarah is. Is she up in the box? I don't know. Sarah, how are you? Well, Sarah, for 30 years, I learned, she told me she'd been a proud member of the Iron Workers Local 44, known as the Cowboys in the Sky. The folks who built built Cincinnati skyline. Sarah said she can't wait to be 10 stories above the Ohio River building that new bridge. God bless her. That's pride. And that's what we're also building. We're building back pride. Look, we're also replacing poisonous lead pipes that go into 10 million homes in America, 400,000 school and child care centers. So every child in America can drink the water instead of having permanent damage to their brain. Look, we're making sure that every community in America has access to affordable high-speed internet. No parent should have to drive by McDonald's parking lot to help them do their homework online with their kids, which many thousands were doing across the country. And when we do these projects, and again, I get criticized for this, but I make no excuses for it, we're going to buy American. We're going to buy American. Folks. And it's totally consistent with international trade rules. Buy America has been the law since 1933, but for too long, past administrations, Democrat and Republican, have fought to get around it. Not anymore. Tonight, I'm announcing new standards require all construction materials used in federal infrastructure projects to be made in America. Made in America. I mean it. Lumber, glass, drywall, fiber optic cable. And on my watch, American roads, bridges, and American highways are going to be made with American products as well. Folks, my economic plan is about investing in places and people that have been forgotten. So many of you listen to me tonight. I know you feel it. So many of you felt like you've just simply been forgotten. Amid the economic upheaval of the past four decades, too many people have been left behind and treated like they're invisible. Maybe that's you watching from home. Remember the jobs that went away. You remember them, don't you? The folks at home remember them. You wonder whether the path even exists anymore for your children to get ahead without having to move away. Well, that's why I get that. That's why we're building an economy where no one's left behind. Jobs are coming back. Pride is coming back. Because choices we made in the last several years. You know, this is, my view, a blue-collar blueprint to rebuild America, make a real difference in your lives at home. For example, too many of you lay in bed at night like my dad did, staring at the ceiling, wondering what in God's names happens if your spouse gets cancer or your child gets deadly ill. Or something happens to you, what are you going to have? You getting money to pay for those medical bills? Or are you going to have to sell the house or try to get a second mortgage on it? I get it. With the Inflation Reduction Act that I signed into law, we're taking on powerful interest to bring health care costs down so you can sleep better at night with more security. You know, we pay more for prescription drugs than any nation in the world. Let me say it again. We pay more for prescription drugs than any major nation on earth. For example, 1 in 10 Americans has diabetes. Many of you in this chamber do, and in the audience. But every day, millions need insulin to control their diabetes so they can literally stay alive. Insulin's been around for over 100 years. The guy who invented it didn't even patent it because he wanted it to be available for everyone. It costs the drug companies roughly $10 a vial to make that insulin. Packaging and all, you may get up to $13. But Big Pharma has been unfairly charging people hundreds of dollars, $400 to $500 a month, making record profits. Not anymore. So many things that we did are only now coming to fruition. We said we were doing this, and we said we passed the law to do it, but people didn't know because the law didn't take effect until January 1 of this year. We capped the cost of insulin at $35 a month for seniors on Medicare. People are just finding out. I'm sure you're getting the same calls I'm getting. Look, there are millions of other Americans who do not or are not on Medicare, including 200,000 young people with type 1 diabetes and need this insulin to stay alive. Let's finish the job this time. Let's cap the cost of insulin for everybody at $35. Folks, the big pharma is still going to do very well, I promise you all. I promise you, they're going to do very well. This law also caps and won't even go into effect until 2025. Costs out-of-pocket drug costs for seniors on Medicare at a maximum of $2,000 a year. You don't have to pay more than $2,000 a year, no matter how much your drug costs are. Because you know why? You all know it. Many of you, like many in my family, have cancer. You know the drugs can range from $10,000, $11,000, $14,000, $15,000 for the cancer drugs. If drug prices rise faster than inflation, drug companies are going to have to pay Medicare back the difference. We're finally giving Medicare the power to negotiate drug prices, bringing down prescription drug costs doesn't just save seniors money. It cuts the federal deficit by billions of dollars. By hundreds of billions of dollars. Because these prescription drugs are drugs purchased by Medicare to keep their commitment to the seniors. Well, guess what? Instead of paying $400 or $500 a month, you're paying $15. That's a lot of savings for the federal government. And by the way, why wouldn't we want that? Now some members here are threatening, and I know it's not an official party position, so I'm going to exaggerate, but certainly to repeal the Inflation Reduction Act. As my coach, that's okay, that's fair. As my football coach used to say, lots of luck in your senior year. Make no mistake, if you try anything to raise the cost of prescription jobs, I will veto it. Pleased to say that more Americans have health insurance now than ever in history. A record 16 million people are enrolled in the Affordable Care Act. And thanks to the law I signed last year, saving $800 a year on their premiums. And by the way, that law was written and the benefit expires in 2025. So my plea to some of you, at least in this audience, let's finish the job and make these savings permanent. Expand coverage of Medicaid. Look, the Inflation Reduction Act is also the most significant investment ever in climate change. Ever. Lowering utility bills, creating American jobs, leading the world to a clean energy future. I visited the devastating aftermath of record floods, droughts, storms, and wildfires from Arizona to New Mexico to all the way up to the Canadian border. More timber has been burned that I've observed from helicopters than the entire state of Missouri. And we don't have global warming? Not a problem. In addition to emergency recovery from Puerto Rico to Florida to Idaho, we're rebuilding for the long term. New electric grids that are able to weather major storms and not prevent those forest fires. Roads and water systems withstand the next big flood. Clean energy to cut pollution and create jobs in communities often left behind. We're going to build 500,000 electric vehicle charging stations installed across the country by tens of thousands of IBEW workers. And we're helping families save more than $1,000 a year with tax credits to purchase electric vehicles and energy-efficient appliances. Historic conservation efforts to be responsible stewards of our land. Let's face reality. The climate crisis doesn't care if you're in a red or blue state. It's an existential threat. We have an obligation, not to ourselves, but to our children and grandchildren, to confront it. I'm proud of how America at last is stepping up to the challenge. We're still going to need oil and gas for a while. But guess what? No, we do. But there's so much more to do. We got to finish the job. And we pay for these investments in our future by finally making the wealthiest and biggest corporations begin to pay their fair share. Just begin. Look, I'm a capitalist. I'm a capitalist, but pay your fair share. I think a lot of you at home agree with me and many people that you know. The tax system is not fair. It is not fair. Look, the idea that in 2020, 55 of the largest corporations in America, the Fortune 500, made $40 billion in profits and paid zero in federal taxes? Zero? Folks, it's simply not fair. But now, because of the law I signed, billion-dollar companies have to pay a minimum of 15%. God love them. 15%. That's less than a nurse pays. And I need to be crystal clear. I said at the very beginning, under my plans, as long as I'm president, nobody earning less than $400,000 will pay an additional penny in taxes. Nobody, not one penny. But let's finish the job. There's more to do. We have to reward work, not just wealth. Pass my proposal for the billionaire minimum tax. You know, there's 1,000 billionaires in America. It's up from about 600 in the beginning of the term. But no billionaire should be paying a lower tax rate than a school teacher or firefighter. I mean it. Think about it. I mean, look. I know you aren't enthusiastic about that, but think about it. Think about it. Have you noticed Big Oil just reported its profits, record profits? Last year, they made $200 billion in the midst of a global energy crisis. I think it's outrageous. Why? They invested too little of that profit to increase domestic production. And when I talk to a couple of them, they say, we're afraid you're going to shut down all the oil wells and all the oil refineries anyway, so why should we invest in them? I said, we're going to need oil for at least another decade, and that's going to exceed and beyond that. We're going to need it. Production. If they had, in fact, invested in the production to keep gas prices down, instead, they used the record profits to buy back their own stock, rewarding the CEOs and shareholders. Corporations ought to do the right thing. That's why I propose we quadruple the tax on corporate stock buybacks and encourage long-term investments. They'll still make considerable profit. Let's finish the job and close the loophole to allow very wealthy to avoid paying their taxes. Instead of cutting the number of audits for wealthy taxpayers, I just signed a law to reduce the deficit by $114 billion by cracking down on wealthy tax cheats. That's being fiscally responsible. In the last 2 years, my administration has cut the deficit by more than $1.7 trillion. the largest deficit reduction in American history. Under the previous administration, the American deficit went up 4 years in a row. Because those record deficits, no president added more to the national debt in any 4 years than my predecessor. Nearly 25% of the entire national debt that took over 200 years to accumulate was added by just one administration alone, the last one. They're the facts. Check it out. Check it out. How did Congress respond to that debt? They did the right thing. They lifted the debt ceiling 3 times without preconditions or crisis. They paid American bills to prevent an economic disaster in the country. So tonight, I'm asking the Congress to follow suit. Let's commit here tonight to the full faith and credit of the United States of America will never, ever be questioned. Some of my Republican friends want to take the economy hostage. I get it, unless I agree to their economic plans. All of you at home should know what those plans are. Instead of making the wealthy pay their fair share, some Republicans want Medicare and Social Security to sunset. I'm not saying it's a majority. Let me give you, anybody who doubts it, contact my office. I'll give you a copy of the proposal. That means Congress doesn't vote. Well, I'm glad to see you. No, I tell you, I enjoy conversion. You know, it means if Congress doesn't keep the programs the way they are, they'd go away. Other Republicans say, I'm not saying it's a majority of you. I don't even think it's even a significant... But it's being proposed by individuals. I'm not politely not naming them, but it's being proposed by some of you. Look, folks, the idea is that we're not going to be moved into being threatened to default on the debt if we don't respond. Folks, so, folks, as we all apparently agree, Social Security and Medicare is off the books now, right? They're not to be stopped. All right. I'm ready. We got unanimity. Social Security and Medicare are a lifeline for millions of seniors. Americans have to pay into them from the very first paycheck they started. So tonight, let's all agree, and we apparently are, let's stand up for seniors. Stand up and show them. We will not cut Social Security. We will not cut Medicare. Those benefits belong to the American people. They earned it. And if anyone tries to cut Social Security, which apparently no one's going to do, and if anyone tries to cut Medicare, I'll stop them. I'll veto it. And look, I'm not going to allow them to be taken away, not today, not tomorrow, not ever. But apparently it's not going to be a problem. Next month, when I offer my fiscal plan, I ask my Republican friends to lay down their plan as well. I really mean it. Let's sit down together and discuss our mutual plans together. Let's do that. I can tell you, the plan I'm going to show is going to cut the deficit by another $2 trillion. And it won't cut a single bit of Medicare or Social Security. In fact, we're going to extend the Medicare Trust Fund at least 2 decades, because that's going to be the next argument. How do we keep it solvent, right? Well, we'll not raise tax on anyone making under 400 grand, but we'll pay for it the way we talked about tonight, by making sure that the wealthy and big corporations pay their fair share. Look. Here's the deal. They aren't just taking advantage of the tax code. They're taking advantage of you, the American consumer. Here's my message to all of you out there. I have your back. We're already preventing Americans from receiving surprise medical bills, stopping $1 billion surprise bills per month so far. We're protecting seniors' life savings by cracking down on nursing homes that commit fraud, endanger patient safety, prescribe drugs that are not needed. Millions of Americans can now save thousands of dollars because they can finally get a hearing aid over the counter without a prescription. Look, capitalism without competition is not capitalism. It's extortion. It's exploitation. Last year, I cracked down with the help of many of you on foreign shipping companies that were making you pay higher prices for every good coming into the country. I signed a bipartisan bill to cut shipping costs by 90%, helping American farmers, businessmen, and consumers. Let's finish the job. Pass the bipartisan legislation to strengthen antitrust enforcement and prevent big online platforms from giving their own products an unfair advantage. My administration is also taking on junk fees, those hidden surcharges too many companies use to make you pay more. For example, we're making airlines show you the full ticket price up front, refund your money if your flight is canceled or delayed. We've reduced exorbitant bank overdrafts by saving consumers more than $1 billion a year. We're cutting credit card late fees by 75%, from $30 to $8. Look, junk fees may not matter to the very wealthy, but they matter to most other folks in homes like the one I grew up in, like many of you did. They add up to hundreds of dollars a month. They make it harder for you to pay your bills or afford that family trip. I know how unfair it feels when a company overcharges you and gets away with it. Not anymore. We've written a bill to stop it all. It's called the Junk Fee Prevention Act. We're going to ban surprise resort fees that hotels charge on your bill. Those fees can cost you up to $90 a night at hotels that aren't even resorts. The idea that cable, internet, and cell phone companies can charge you $200 or more if you decide to switch to another provider. Give me a break. We can stop service fees on tickets to concerts and sporting events and make companies disclose all the fees up front. And we'll prohibit airlines from charging $50 round trip for family just to be able to sit together. Baggage fees are bad enough. Airlines can't treat your child like a piece of baggage. Americans are tired of being. We're tired of being played for suckers. So pass the Junk Fee Prevention Act so companies stop ripping us off. For too long, workers have been getting stiffed, but not anymore. We're beginning to restore the dignity of work. For example, I should have known this, but I didn't until 2 years ago. 30 million workers have to sign non-compete agreements for the jobs they take. 30 million. So a cashier at a burger place can't walk across town and take the same job at another burger place and make a few bucks more. It just changed. But they just changed it because we exposed it. That was part of the deal, guys. Look it up. But not anymore. We're banning those agreements so companies have to compete for workers and pay them what they're worth. And I must tell you, this is bound to get a response from my friends on my left, but the right. I'm so sick and tired of companies breaking the law by preventing workers from organizing. Pass the PRO Act, because business have a right. Workers have a right to form a union. And let's guarantee all workers have a living wage. Let's make sure working parents can afford to raise a family with sick days, paid family medical leave, affordable child care. That's going to enable millions of more people to go and stay at work. And let's restore the full child tax credit, which gave tens of millions of parents some breathing room and cut child poverty in half to the lowest level in history. And by the way, when we do all these things, we increase productivity. We increase economic growth. So let's finish the job and get more families access to affordable, quality housing. Let's get seniors who want to stay in their homes the care they need to do so. Let's give more breathing room to millions of family caregivers looking after their loved ones. Pass my plan so we get seniors and people with disabilities the home care and services they need. And support the workers who are doing God's work. These plans are fully paid for, and we can afford to do them. Restoring the dignity of work means making education an affordable ticket to the middle class. You know, when we made public education, 12 years of it, universal in the last century, we made the best educated, best paid, we became the best educated, best paid nation in the world. But the rest of the world's caught up. It's caught up. Jill, my wife, who teaches full time, has an expression. I hope I get it right, kid. Any nation that out-educates us is going to out-compete us. Any nation that out-educates is going to out-compete us. Folks, we all know 12 years of education is not enough to win the economic competition of the 21st century. You want to have the best educated workforce, let's finish the job. By providing access to preschool for 3 and 4 years old. Studies show that children who go to preschool are nearly 50% more likely to finish high school and go on to earn a 2 or 4 year degree, no matter their background they came from. Let's give public school teachers a raise. We're making progress by reducing student debt, increasing Pell Grants for working and middle-class families. Let's finish the job and connect students to career opportunities starting in high school. Provide access to 2 years of community college, the best career training in America, in addition to being a pathway to a 4-year degree. Let's offer every American a path to a good career, whether they go to college or not. And folks, in the midst of the COVID crisis, when schools were closed and we were shutting down everything, let's recognize how far we came in the fight against the pandemic itself. While the virus is not gone, thanks to the resilience of the American people and the ingenuity of medicine, we've broken the COVID grip on us. COVID deaths are down by 90%. We've saved millions of lives and opened up our country. We opened our country back up, and soon we'll end the public health emergency. But that's called a public health emergency. But we'll remember the toll and pain that's never going to go away. More than 1 million Americans lost their lives to COVID. 1 million. Families grieving, children orphaned. Empty chairs at the dining room table constantly reminding you that she used to sit there. Remembering them, we remain vigilant. We still need to monitor dozens of variants and support new vaccines and treatments. So Congress needs to fund these efforts and keep America safe. And as we emerge from this crisis stronger, we're also got to double down on prosecuting criminals who stole relief money meant to keep workers and small businesses afloat. Before I came to office, you remember, during that campaign, the big issue was about inspector generals who would protect taxpayers' dollars who were sidelined. They were fired. Many people said, we don't need them. And fraud became rampant. Last year, I told you the watchdogs are back. Since then, we've recovered billions of taxpayers' dollars. Now let's triple the anti-fraud strike force going after these criminals, double the statute of limitations on these crimes, and crack down on identity fraud by criminal syndicates stealing billions of dollars from the American people. And the data shows that for every dollar we put into fighting fraud, the tax rate get back at least 10 times as much. It matters. It matters. Look, COVID left its scars, like the spike in violent crime in 2020, the first year of the pandemic. We have an obligation to make sure all people are safe. Public safety depends on public trust, as all of us know. But too often that trust is violated. Join us tonight are the parents of Tyree Nichols. Welcome. I had to bury Tyree last week. As many of you personally know, there's no words to describe the heartache or grief of losing a child. But imagine. Imagine if you lost that child at the hands of the law. Imagine having to worry whether your son or daughter came home from walking down the street, playing in the park, or just driving a car. Most of us in here have never had to have the talk that brown and black parents have had to have with their children. Bo, Hunter, Ashley, my children, I never had to have the talk with them. I never had to tell them if a police officer pulls you over, turn your interior lights on right away. Don't reach for your license. Keep your hands on the steering wheel. Imagine having to worry like that every single time your kid got in a car. Here's what Tyree's mother shared with me when I spoke to her. When I asked her how she finds the courage to carry on and speak out. The faith of God, she said her son was, quote, a beautiful soul, and something good will come of this. Imagine how much courage and carry that takes. It's up to us, to all of us. We all want the same thing. Neighborhoods free of violence. Law enforcement who earns the community's trust. Just as every cop, when they pin on that badge in the morning, has a right to be able to go home at night, so does everybody else out there. Our children have a right to come home safely. Equal protection under the law is a covenant we have with each other in America. We know police officers put their lives on the line every single night and day. And we know we ask them in many cases to do too much to be counselors, social workers, psychologists, responding to drug overdoses, mental health crises, and so much more. In one sense, we ask much too much of them. I know most cops and their families are good, decent, honorable people, the vast majority. But they risk. And they risk their lives every time they put that shield on. But what happened to Tyree in Memphis happens too often. We have to do better. Give law enforcement the real training they need. Hold them to higher standards. Help them succeed in keeping us safe. We also need more first responders and professionals to address the growing mental health, substance abuse challenges. More resources to reduce violent crime and gun crime. More community intervention programs. More investment in housing, education, and job training. All this can help prevent violence in the first place. When police officers or police departments violate the public trust, they must be held accountable. With the support of the families of victims, civil rights groups, and law enforcement, I signed an executive order for all federal officers banning chokeholds, restricting no-knock warrants, and other key elements of the George Floyd Act. Let's commit ourselves to make the words of Tyler's mom true. Something good must come from this. Something good. And all of us, Folks, it's difficult, but it's simple. All of us in this chamber, we need to rise to this moment. We can't turn away. Let's do what we know in our hearts that we need to do. Let's come together to finish the job on police reform. Do something. Do something. That was the plea of parents who lost their children in Uvalde. I met with every one of them. Do something about gun violence. Thank God. Thank God we did. Passing the most sweeping gun safety law in three decades. That includes things like that the majority of responsible gun owners already support. Enhanced background checks for 18 to 21 years old. Red flag laws, keeping guns out of the hands of people who are a danger to themselves and others. But we know our work is not done. Join us tonight is Brandon Say, a 26-year-old hero. Brandon put his college dreams on hold to be at his mom's side. His mom's side when she was dying from cancer. And Brandon, Brandon now works at the dance studio started by his grandparents. And 2 weeks ago, during the Lunar New Year celebrations, he heard the studio door close, and he saw a man standing there pointing a semi-automatic pistol at him. He thought he was going to die, but he thought about the people inside. And in that instant, he found the courage to act and wrestle the semi-automatic pistol away from the gunman who had already killed 11 people in another dance studio. 11. He saved lives. It's time we do the same. Ban assault weapons now. Ban them now. Once and for all. I led the fight to do that in 1994. And in 10 years, that ban was law. Mass shootings went down. After we let it expire in the Republican administration, mass shootings tripled. Let's finish the job and ban these assault weapons. And let's also come together on immigration. Make it a bipartisan issue once again. We know we now have a record number of personnel working to secure the border, arresting 8,000 human smugglers, seizing over 23,000 pounds of fentanyl in just the last several months. We've launched a new border plan last month. Unlawful migration from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela has come down 97% as a consequence of that. But American border problems won't be fixed until Congress acts. If we don't pass my comprehensive immigration reform, at least pass my plan to provide the equipment and officers to secure the border. And a pathway to citizenship for dreamers, those on temporary status, farm workers, essential workers. Here in the People's House, it's our duty to protect all the people's rights and freedoms. Congress must restore the right and the... Congress must restore the right that was taken away in Roe v. Wade and protect Roe v. Wade. Give every woman a consular right. The Vice President and I are doing everything to protect access to reproductive health care and safeguard patient safety. But already, more than a dozen states are enforcing extreme abortion bans. Make no mistake about it. If Congress passes a national ban, I will veto it. But let's also pass the Bipartisan Equality Act to ensure LGBTQ Americans, especially transgender young people, can live with safety and dignity. Our strength is not just the example of our power, but the power of our example. Let's remember the world's watching. I spoke in this chamber 1 year ago, just days after Vladimir Putin unleashed his brutal attack against Ukraine. A murderous assault, evoking images of death and destruction Europe suffered in World War II. Putin's invasion has been a test for the ages, a test for America, a test for the world. Would we stand for the most basic of principles? Would we stand for sovereignty? We stand for the right of people to live free of tyranny? Will we stand for the defense of democracy? For such defense matters to us because it keeps peace and prevents open season on would-be aggressors and threatens our prosperity. 1 year later, we know the answer. Yes, we would, and we did. We did. And together, we did what America always does at our best. We led. We united NATO. We built a global coalition. We stood against Putin's aggression. We stood with the Ukrainian people. Tonight, we're once again joined by Ukraine's ambassador to the United States. She represents not her, just her nation, but the courage of her people. Our ambassador is here. We're united in our support of your country. Will you stand so we can all take a look at you? Thank you. Because we're going to stand with you as long as it takes. Our nation's working for more freedom, more dignity, more peace, not just in Europe, but everywhere. Before I came to office, the story was about how the People's Republic of China was increasing its power and America was failing in the world. Not anymore. We made clear, and I made clear in my personal conversations, which have been many, with President Xi, that we seek competition, not conflict. But I will make no apologies that we're investing in, to make America stronger, investing in American innovation and industries that will define the future that China intends to be dominating, investing in our alliances and working with our allies to protect advanced technologies so they will not be used against us, modernizing our military to safeguard stability and deter aggression. Today, we're in the strongest position in decades to compete with China or anyone else in the world. Anyone else in the world. And I'm committed. I'm committed to work with China where we can advance American interests and benefit the world. But make no mistake about it. As we made clear last week, if China threatens our sovereignty, we will act to protect our country, and we did. Look, let's be clear. Winning the competition should unite all of us. We face serious challenges across the world. But in the past 2 years, democracies have become stronger, not weaker. Autocracy has grown weaker, not stronger. Name me a world leader who changed places with Xi Jinping. Name me one. Name me one. America's rallying the world to meet those challenges, from climate to global health, to food insecurity, to terrorism, to territorial aggression. Allies are stepping up, spending more, and doing more. Look, the bridges we're forming between partners in the Pacific and those in the Atlantic, and those who bet against America are learning how wrong they are. It's never, ever been a good bet to bet against America. Never. Well, when I came to office, most assured that bipartisanship assumed was impossible, but never believed it. That's why a year ago I offered a unity agenda to the nation as I stood here. We made real progress together. We passed the law making it easy for doctors to prescribe effective treatments for opioid addiction. We passed the gun safety law making historic investments in mental health. We launched the ARPA-H drive for breakthrough in the fights against cancer, Alzheimer's, and diabetes, and so much more. We passed the Heath Robinson Pact Act, named after the late Iraq War veteran whose story about exposure to toxic burn kits I shared here last year. I understand something about those burn pits, but there's so much more to do. We can do it together. Joining us tonight is a father named Doug from Newton, New Hampshire. He wrote Jill, my wife, a letter, and me as well, about his courageous daughter, Courtney. A contagious laugh, his sister's best friend, her sister's best friend. He shared a story all too familiar to millions of Americans and many of you in the audience. Courtney discovered pills in high school. It spiraled into addiction and eventually death from a fentanyl overdose. She was just 20 years old. Describing the last 8 years without her, Doug said, "There's no worse pain." Yet their family has turned pain to purpose, working to end the stigma and change laws. He told us he wants to start a journey toward American recovery. Doug, we're with you. Fentanyl is killing more than 70,000 Americans a year. Big, you got it. So let's launch a major surge to stop fentanyl production in the sale and trafficking, with more drug detection machines, inspection cargo, stop pills and powder at the border. Working with couriers like FedEx to inspect more packages for drugs. Strong penalties to crack down on fentanyl trafficking. Second, let's do more on mental health, especially for our children. When millions of young people are struggling with bullying, violence, trauma, we owe them greater access to mental health care at their schools. We must finally hold social media companies accountable for experimenting they're doing running children for profit. It's time to pass bipartisan legislation to stop big tech from collecting personal data on our kids and teenagers online, ban targeted advertising to children, and impose stricter limits on the personal data that companies collect on all of us. Third, let's do more to keep this nation's one truly sacred obligation to equip those we send into harm's way and care for them and their families when they come home. Job training, job placement for veterans and their spouses as they come to return to civilian life. Helping veterans afford the rent, because no one should be homeless in America, especially someone who served the country. Dennis McDonough is here, the VA. We had a first real discussion when I asked him to take the job. I'm glad he did. We were losing up to 25 veterans a day on suicide. Now we're losing 17 a day to the silent scourge of suicide. 17 veterans a day are committing suicide, more than all the people being killed in the wars. Folks, VA is doing everything it can, including expanding mental health screening, proven programs that recruits veterans to help other veterans understand what they're going through, get them the help they need. We got to do more. And fourth, last year, Jill and I reignited the cancer moonshot that I was able to start with President Obama asked me to lead our administration on this issue. Our goal is to cut the cancer death rates at least by 50% in the next 25 years. Turn more cancers from death sentences to treatable diseases. Provide more support for patients and their families. It's personal to so many of us in this audience. Joining us are Morris and Candice, an Irishman and a daughter of immigrants from Panama. They met and fell in love in New York City and got married in the same chapel Jill and I got married in New York City. kindred spirits. He wrote us a letter about his little daughter, Ava, and I saw her just before I came over. She was just a year old when she was diagnosed with rare kidney disease, cancer. After 26 blood transfusions, 11 rounds of radiation, 8 rounds of chemo, 1 kidney removed, given a 5% survival rate. He wrote how, in the darkest moments, he thought, if she goes, I can't stay. Many of you have been through that as well. Jillian, I understand that, like so many of you. And he read Jill's book describing our family's cancer journey and how we tried to steal moments of joy where we could with Beau. For them, that glimmer of joy was the half smile of their baby girl. It meant everything to them. They never gave up hope. Little Ava never gave up hope. She turns 4 next month.
They just found out Ava's beating the odds, is on her way to being cured of cancer. And she's watching from the White House tonight, and she's not asleep already. For the lives we can save. For the lives we can save and the lives we've lost, let this be a truly American moment that rallies the country and the world together and prove that we can still do big things. 20 years ago, under the leadership of President Bush and countless advocates and champions, he undertook a bipartisan effort through PEPFAR to transform the global fight against HIV/AIDS. It's been a huge success. He thought big. He thought large. He moved. I believe we can do the same thing with cancer. Let's end cancer as we know it. Cure some cancers once and for all. Folks, there's one reason why we've been able to do all of these things. Our democracy itself. It's the most fundamental thing of all. With democracy, everything's possible. Without it, nothing is. For the last few years, our democracy has been threatened and attacked, put at risk, put to the test in this very room on January the 6th. And then just a few months ago, an unhinged big lie assailed and unleashed a political violence at the home of the then Speaker of the House of Representatives, using the very same language the insurrectionists used as they stalked these halls and chanted on January 6th. Here tonight in this chamber is a man who bears the scars of that brutal attack, but is as tough and as strong and as resilient as they get. My friend, Paul Pelosi. Paul, stand up. But such a heinous act should have never happened. We must all speak out. There's no place for political violence in America. We have to protect the right to vote, not suppress the fat fundamental right. Honor the results of our elections, not subvert the will of the people. We have to uphold the rule of law and restore trust in our institutions of democracy. And we must give hate and extremism in any form no safe harbor.
Democracy must not be a partisan issue. It's an American issue. Every generation of Americans has faced a moment where they have been called to protect our democracy, defend it, stand up for it. And this is our moment. My fellow Americans, we meet tonight at an inflection point, one of those moments that only a few generations ever face, where the direction we now take is going to decide the course of this nation for decades to come. We're not bystanders of history. We're not powerless before the forces that confront us. It's within our power of we, the people. We're facing the test of our time. We have to be the nation we've always been at our best, optimistic, hopeful, forward-looking. A nation that embraces light over dark, hope over fear, unity over division, stability over chaos. We have to see each other not as enemies, but as fellow Americans. We're good people. The only nation in the world built on an idea. The only one. Other nations are defined by geography, ethnicity. But we're the only nation based on an idea that all of us, every one of us, is created equal in the image of God. A nation that stands as a beacon to the world. A nation in a new age of possibilities. So I've come to fulfill my constitutional obligation to report in the State of the Union. And here's my report. Because the soul of this nation is strong, because the backbone of this nation is strong, because the people of this nation are strong, the State of the Union is strong. I'm not new to this place. I stand here tonight having served as long as about any one of you have ever served here. But I've never been more optimistic about our future, about the future of America. We just remember who we are. We're the United States of America, and there's nothing beyond our capacity if we do it together. God bless you all, and may God protect our troops. Thank you.
You're watching Al Jazeera English, where President Joe Biden has addressed a joint House of Congress and the State of the Union. He was presenting for at least an hour and 20 minutes. Let's cross over to Kimberly Halkett. Kimberly, you've been obviously assessing exactly what the president said. He touched on what would have been a very domestic agenda to start with, everything from employment to political infighting, manufacturing, federal debt, healthcare, big pharma, taxes. He was obviously appealing to the domestic audience, but it had a touch of bipartisan approach everywhere with the phrase, let's get the job done.
Yeah, and I think what was really remarkable about this speech was a moment kind of in the center of the speech there, something that you really don't see often in Washington. And it was when the president broke away from his prepared remarks and began negotiating live in the middle of his speech with opposition Republicans. It was a remarkable moment. What he was doing there was really talking and showing his skills as someone who's been in Washington for decades, not only as a president, as a vice president, but also as a member of Congress. The issue is somewhat complicated. It's about raising the debt limit in the United States so that it can pay for social programs like Medicare and Social Security. These are government programs to help the elderly and those in the United States that need kind of a step up and help. And right now, many Republicans, that's the opposition party of the president's Democratic Party, are opposed to raising this limit. And so you heard there's some pushback in the middle of the speech as the president was making that case. So he turned his body and said, let's stand up for seniors. And he got this rare moment of sort of unanimity. He saw the president saying, that's something we all can agree on. And he delivered on a campaign promise right there in the middle of his speech. It showed his skills as a statesman, and it really showed that he was able to deliver on a campaign promise that, honestly, up until now, he has not been able to deliver on. He campaigned that he said, look, I have the experience, I have the ability to unite this divided America. And up until now, there's been a lot of skepticism that he's been able to do that. But there in live television, he delivered on that. And it really was remarkable to see that moment. Even as his critics were challenging him, yelling, liar, you saw both sides standing up, both Republicans and Democrats, and it really was kind of the highlight of the speech. Sure, there were other great moments for the president, but that is the one that is likely to capture headlines. And I can tell you, in covering many State of the Unions as a reporter in Washington, it's not something that I've ever seen before, where you've sort of seen these two parties coming together, negotiating over legislation in the middle of a State of the Union address. It was really quite remarkable.
Kimberly Halkett there, our White House correspondent. Thanks, Kimberly. Of course, we'll be unpicking exactly what the president's been saying, I'm sure, throughout the day. But let's cross over now to our Washington Broadcast Center, where we're joined by Republican strategist John Feary. And he's alongside Democratic strategist Amisha Cross, a fellow at the Truman National Security Project. Let's talk to Amisha first. Good to have you both on the programme, and thanks for joining us on Al Jazeera. Amisha, just your initial reaction to what I would describe as a very animated and very forthright president who is making his agenda and policy very clear for the American public.
President Biden knocked it out of the park.
My view is that...
For anyone who wasn't...
No, please carry on, Amisha. We'll come to you in a moment, John.
For anyone who wasn't aware of his achievements, he went down the list from chips to infrastructure to historic investments in healthcare and reducing the cost of pharmaceutical drugs, particularly insulin, making sure that America gets back on track with competitiveness in terms of the efforts in student loan reduction. Everything that needed to be hit on, he hit on in this speech. I think in addition to really showcasing his prowess as a leader, as a former legislator, as someone who understands that room very well, in getting Republicans essentially to commit to not gutting Social Security, to not gutting retirement, to make sure that these things are taken very seriously, to make sure that Medicare isn't on the chopping block. These are things that really matter to the American people. And I think that President Biden fully understood that, and he wove a very, very strong tapestry of his efforts and the Democratic Party's efforts in ensuring that America gets back on track.
So, Amisha, let me just jump in there. How difficult do you think it's going to be for him to navigate away from the cameras, behind closed doors? Because what's said in public is often very difficult to negotiate, even when you're trying to get bipartisan approaches to most things. He did talk about the infrastructure project and the bridge in Kentucky, which was a very popular bipartisan approach and something that both Mitch McConnell was very agreeable to. But that's just one incident, isn't it?
Absolutely. And a slim majority for Republicans in the House is still a majority for Republicans in the House. There is an uphill battle that this president is going to have in getting certain things passed. I think that that is widely acknowledged, particularly because Republicans are more interested in fighting culture wars, in the animation we've seen across several states, and in, quite frankly, moving away from what the American public actually wants to see in terms of legislative change. Okay. But Joe Biden has worked in this type of environment before. He's the strongest in terms of building allies, particularly those from, and he only needs a handful from across the other side of the aisle. I think he's going to get the job done.
Okay, let's cross over to John. John, let me just get your initial impressions of what you thought. Obviously, many Republicans wouldn't have agreed with much of what President Biden has achieved. Would you agree or disagree?
You know, what I was struck by this speech was it was kind of a return to normalcy. It's been a long time since we've had kind of a normal State of the Union address where people... We were in a post-COVID world where there was elements from Bill Clinton where he had a bunch of small things that he wanted to talk about, like getting rid of junk fees. He was at times bipartisan where he was trying to, you know, congratulate both Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy. I think those were very strong elements for the president. There were other elements where Republicans would have, you know, appreciated, you know, this whole straw man out there that the Republicans were going to, you know, slash Social Security or Medicare. They never were going to do that. They don't have the votes to do that. They don't want to do that. Donald Trump certainly didn't want to do that. There was other things that he, you know, sounded a little bit like Donald Trump. Like, we got to, you know, get the border enforced. We need to do this something with fentanyl. We need to stand up to China. That sounded a little Trumpian to me. And then there were things that he had to, you know, really kind of lay the base and be with the base that, you know, Democrats liked and Republicans didn't like. So, there was a long speech. It was not unusual for a State of the Union. They had a lot of different elements to it.
Yeah.
I think the speech was better written than delivered. I think he really hurried through the speech, which, thank God, because it was still an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I think that, like most States of the Union, it was kind of effective.
Okay, let's just take one of the subjects, which is the economy. It's something that obviously resonates across the board, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. And, John, can I just ask you about the issues of the economy when it comes to investment in America first, making things in America? Do you think that's going to resonate with the public at large across the U.S.? And is this going to impress them? Because State of the Union Union is obviously, you might say, a fundamental foundation for laying the groundwork should he want to, as he says, want to run for the presidency again.
Well, you know, I think that this is also an element that Donald Trump talked about, which was we need to have all these products made in America. You know, it sounds really good in you know, when you talk about the rhetoric. It does add a lot of cost to all of your government spending. So there, you know, the worldwide global economy has done a wonderful job of keeping prices low for American consumers. So there's a choice you have to make. Do you want to increase the cost of products and have them all made in America, or do you want to buy the cheapest products elsewhere? And so, you know, I think the president was saying, you know, something that sounds very good for the average American voter, but for the average American consumer, it's going to be much more costly.
Amisha, we're just coming near to the end of the program. So just very quickly, he did touch upon the whole drug problem across the US with various people and families in the gallery looking at what's going on. How problematic is this for any administration in the White House to deal with the issue of drug abuse?
Well, the rising crisis of opioid use and opioid abuse is something that we have dealt with now for close to a decade. And I think that the president put an eye on it that needs to be there in terms of attention. When it comes to reduction, there needs to be more clinics, more availability and affordability for those who need help to get that help. In addition to health care that allows for those who aren't just at the top when it comes to wealth, but also those who are in poverty to be able to access that help. And honestly, I would hope that this extends beyond the opioid crisis, but also to individuals who have been addicted to things like crack cocaine, where we know that the response, particularly as it relates to drug abuse, has been vastly different when you look at drug abuse and the method that it is being used now, when a lot of the abusers are typically white Americans, versus historically how this has been treated when those have been when the victims have been people of color.
Amisha, it's interesting to get your context and your analysis, as well as John Free. Thanks so much for both of you for joining us here on Al Jazeera. And of course, we'll leave you with some of the pictures and images of President Biden finalizing and saying goodbye to the various politicians in Congress as he delivered his State of the Union address. We'll have more on this throughout the day. Stay with us here on Al Jazeera.